Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Hundreds of people continue to be arrested every week during demonstrations in Belarus, where protesters have been systematically and violently dispersed, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said on Friday. Addressing the Human Rights Council in Geneva, the High Commissioner for Human Rights expressed deep concern about use of force violations by security forces. Ms. Bachelet, who maintained that the situation in Belarus had seen no improvement since protesters began contesting the result of presidential elections in August, said that reportedly around 1,000 people were arrested on the 8th of November and 700 on the 15th. She told member states that allegations of injuries caused by crowd dispersal measures and of ill treatment during arrests have continued to emerge, and that at least 4 people had died.
Numerous accounts describe demonstrators and passers-by being randomly chased, kicked, and severely beaten with batons during the dispersal of rallies. We also have multiple and credible reports of people beaten by members of the security forces during and after their transport to police stations or detention centers. If confirmed, such incidents should constitute ill-treatment and in some cases may amount to torture.
In reply, Belarus's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva, Yuri Ambrazovich, said that most people were continuing with their normal lives in the country and that the government was functioning, as were factories and offices. The UN is doing its utmost to secure aid access to Ethiopia's Tigray region, it said on Friday, after a deal was struck to reach displaced civilians affected by weeks of fighting between federal and regional forces. The development comes after an earlier announcement that the Ethiopian government had authorized unimpeded, sustained, and secure humanitarian access to reach those in need across areas now under its control in the northeastern area. In Geneva, UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Babar Balok said that more than 47,000 Ethiopian refugee arrivals have reached Sudan so far, with more expected. But there's still concern for tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees still inside Tigray. Here's World Food Programme spokesperson Thompson Firi.
WFP's priority is to locate some of the 50,000 Eritrean refugees who, before the conflict, received food assistance in 4 camps in Tigray. It is possible that some may have fled by now in search of safety.
The impact of the conflict on civilians is also a major worry amid warnings from the World Health Organization, WHO, that the worsening of the COVID-19 pandemic in the region was to be expected, along with injuries, malnutrition and communicable diseases such as malaria. A new outbreak of yellow fever in Nigeria has caused many deaths across 5 states, and tackling it is proving difficult because of the COVID crisis and insecurity in the northeast, the World Health Organization, WHO, has said. Nigeria has been battling successive outbreaks of the preventable disease since 2017. The latest episode has affected Delta, Enugu, Bauchi, Benue and Ebonyi states. WHO said that 530 suspected cases have been reported to date and that 172 people have died, before stressing the value of the highly effective, affordable and safe vaccine, which provides lifelong protection from yellow fever. Protecting communities is particularly challenging, as Nigeria is also facing ongoing outbreaks of Lassa fever, measles, monkeypox and cholera, along with the humanitarian crisis in the northeast of the country linked to violent extremists. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Dear friends, I have detailed an emergency, but I also see hope. I see a history of advances that show what can be done, from rescuing the ozone layer to reducing extinction rates to expanding protected areas. Many cities are becoming greener. The circular economy is reducing waste. Environmental laws have growing reach. At least 155 United Nations member states now legally recognize that a healthy environment is a basic human right. And the knowledge base is greater than ever. I was very pleased to learn by President Bollinger that Columbia University has launched a climate school, the first new school here in a quarter of a century. Congratulations. This is a wonderful demonstration of scholarship and leadership. And I'm delighted to know that so many members of the Sustainable Development Solutions Network are with us today as special guests, university presidents, chancellors, deans, faculty and other scholars. The United Nations Academic Impact Initiative is working with institutions of higher education across the globe. And the contributions of universities are essential to our success. Dear friends, a new world is taking shape. More and more people are recognizing the limits of conventional yardsticks, such as gross domestic product, in which environmentally damaging activities count as economic positives. Mindsets are shifting. More and more people are understanding the need for their own daily choices to reduce their carbon footprint and respect planetary boundaries. And we see inspiring waves of social mobilization by young people, from protests in the streets to advocacy online, from classroom education to community engagement, from voting booths to places of work. Young people are pushing their elders to do what is right, and we are in a university. This is a moment of truth for people and planet alike. COVID and climate have brought us to a threshold. We cannot go back to the old normal of inequality, injustice, and endless dominion over the earth. Instead, we must step towards a safer, more sustainable, and equitable path. We have a blueprint, the 2030 Agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, and the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. The door is open, the solutions are there. Now is the time to transform humankind's relationship with the natural world and with each other. And we must do so together. Solidarity is humanity. Solidarity is survival. That is the lesson of 2020. With the world in disunity and disarray, trying to contain the pandemic, let's learn the lesson and change course for the pivotal period ahead. And I thank you.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, in a world facing famine, major migration and conflict exacerbated by COVID-19, the UN, including its foundational body, the Economic and Social Council, known as ECOSOC, is vital to promote global peace and cooperation. That's according to Munir Akram, Pakistan's ambassador to the UN, who was elected ECOSOC president in July. He said that urgent action needs to be taken now to meet the needs of developing countries, otherwise we'll have a humanitarian disaster on our hands, he told UN News' Liz Scafidi, but began the interview by explaining ECOSOC's overall role.
The Economic and Social Council is one of the three principal organs are mentioned in the UN Charter. The General Assembly, the Security Council, and the Economic and Social Council. These are three main charter bodies. And the concept of creating the Economic and Social Council at the time of the birth of the United Nations was that on the one side, the Security Council was conceived as an organ which would promote collective security and enforce peace in the world. The Economic and Social Council, on the other hand, was designed to promote peace through international economic cooperation. One of the framers of the UN Charter was the President of the United States, Mr. Roosevelt, and his conception, which he voiced at the time, was that economic instability was like a disease, and that if one country had it, then others would be affected. And that was the concept behind the creation of the Economic and Social Council to promote peace through international development cooperation. So the Charter says very clearly that the objective of the Economic and Social Council is to promote better standards of living in larger freedoms. That is a quote from the UN Charter. And it's supposed to do that, firstly, by addressing policy issues, and secondly, by promoting international cooperation and coordination among all international economic organizations. That's the mandate, and it's a mandate which is, I believe, just as important as the mandate of the UN Security Council.
Can you share some examples of ECOSOC's work in New York that has had a global impact?
Yes. Over the years, the Economic and Social Council has been a place where the whole concept of development cooperation, of helping developing countries to make progress and grow, was conceived. So it was at the Economic and Social Council that the first report, which was called the Pearson Report on Development Cooperation, was discussed. And the whole idea of promoting economic and social development through mutual support between rich and poor countries was born. ECOSOC was the place where we conceived of what was then called the International Development Strategy. It is the place where the concept of official development assistance amounting to 0.7% of the GDP of developed countries to be provided to developing countries was born. It was in ECOSOC that the concept of linking the creation of special drawing rights in the IMF, the IMF quotas, to link those quotas with development assistance. These were all major ideas that were born in the ECOSOC and are now practiced in major financial and international economic institutions. So it has been a central body for forward thinking, and these are just some examples of what has been achieved in ECOSOC in the past.
What is the correlation between the SDGs and ECOSOC?
The Sustainable Development Goals were the product of a long process of discussion within the UN system. I would not say that they originated in one place, but certainly the predecessor of the Sustainable Development Goals were called the Millennium Development Goals. They were more modest, and they were born in a process between the Economic and Social Council and the General Assembly. The Sustainable Development Goals were evolved not only in ECOSOC, but also in major conferences such as the Rio Conference on Climate and Development, the environmental conferences that were held, as well as the summits of the General Assembly, the Millennium Summit, and then the summit held in 2010 and 2015. It was at the 2015 General Assembly Summit, to which ECOSOC contributed, that the Sustainable Development Goals were adopted.
How is the COVID-19 pandemic challenging the work of ECOSOC?
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic, as we all know, is a major health crisis. It's the biggest pandemic that we've had in over a century. But it has also had major economic consequences. It is the deepest recession the world has faced since the 1930s. It has contracted the world economy by almost 10%, and perhaps it will be more than that. Some developing countries have contracted by over 20-25% in their economies. Over 100 million people are going to fall back into extreme poverty as a result of the damage to their economies and the lack of growth in their economies, the destruction of almost 300 million plus jobs across the world. So it has had a devastating impact. The richer countries, as you know, have pumped in about $13 trillion in fiscal stimulus to revive their economies. And even they are struggling. The developing countries need between $2 to $3 trillion to revive their economies, and they have not had access to even a small fraction of that amount. So many countries are falling into debt. Many countries are failing to pay back their debts. Economic collapse is confronting a number of vulnerable countries, and the consequences of such collapse will be devastating, not only on their regions, but on the world economy as a whole.
Racial tension has been running high around the world. How can ECOSOC help to mitigate this?
Well, I believe that the best answer for tensions of all nature is economic and social development, equitable development. In ECOSOC, we are going to convene a conference on the 20th anniversary of the Durban Conference on Racism. And this conference will be on racism and inequality. And I believe that if we can address inequality in all its forms, we will be able also to address the problem of racism and other forms of discrimination that people confront in so many countries and societies.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I believe that in the current circumstances, the United Nations, including ECOSOC, is vital to promote global peace and global cooperation. We need to take urgent actions to meet the needs of the developing countries, otherwise we will have a humanitarian disaster on our hands. We are facing the prospect of famine, we're facing the prospect of major migration, and we are facing then the prospect of conflict. We will not be able to achieve these sustainable development goals. We will not be able to address the climate action that is required to avert a climate disaster. And therefore, it is essential that at this time, the global community respond to the plights of the poor and to take urgent actions to provide them the support that they need to survive in this post-pandemic situation.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The state of the planet is broken, and now is the time to transform humankind's relationship with the natural world and with each other, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in an address at Columbia University in New York on Wednesday. He said the world is facing a devastating pandemic, global warming, ecological degradation, and setbacks in achieving sustainable development. But as human activities are at the root of this descent towards chaos, human action can help solve it.
Making peace with nature is the defining task of the 21st century. It must be the top priority for everyone, everywhere. In this context, the recovery from the pandemic is an opportunity. We can see rays of hope in the form of a vaccine, but there is no vaccine for the planet. Nature needs a bailout.
The UN chief said overcoming the pandemic could be an opportunity to transform the world economy through promotion of renewable energy sources, which will create new jobs, cleaner infrastructure, and a resilient future. He also stressed the need for all countries to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050, in line with the Paris Agreement on climate change. In related news, countries must reduce production of fossil fuels by 6% per year over the next decade if the planet is to avert catastrophic global temperature rise, according to a new UN-backed report issued on Wednesday. The Production Gap Report measures the gap between the aspirations of the Paris Agreement on climate change and countries' planned production of coal, oil, and gas. This production gap remains large, the authors said, as countries plan to produce more than double the amount of fossil fuels in 2030 than would be consistent with the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature limit specified in the agreement. The report further revealed that although there were short-term drops in coal, oil, and gas production due to the COVID-19 pandemic, production is set to increase based on pre-crisis plans as well as stimulus measures. Inger Andersen, head of the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, one of the partners behind the study, said investing in low-carbon energy and infrastructure will be good for jobs, economies, and human health as the world seeks to recover from the pandemic. Meanwhile, COVID-19 is likely to drive down wages in the near future, the UN Labour Organization, ILO, said in a report published on Wednesday. Covering more than 130 countries, it found monthly wages fell or grew more slowly during the first 6 months of the year due to the pandemic in two-thirds of the countries for which official data was available. Women and low-paid workers were disproportionately affected. And while average wages in one-third of countries appeared to increase, this was mainly due to large numbers of lower-paid workers losing their jobs, thus skewing the numbers. ILO chief Guy Ryder said recovery from the pandemic must be human-centered, with wage policies that take into account job sustainability while also addressing inequalities. Deanne Penn, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The state of the planet is broken and...
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. For the International Day of Persons with Disabilities, a message from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who's called for greater inclusion for all those with a handicap, along with greater recognition and protection of their rights. Specifically, Mr. Guterres said that these rights included the right to go to school, live in the community, access healthcare, and start a family. Everyone should have the right to engage politically, to play sport, travel, and have decent work, the UN chief insisted in his message for the International Day on the 3rd of December. He explained that people with disabilities had been among the worst affected by the coronavirus pandemic and that they are more likely to live in poverty and experience higher rates of violence, neglect and abuse. To reports now that Bangladesh authorities may be preparing to move Rohingya refugees who fled Myanmar to an island in the Bay of Bengal. Nearly 900,000 Rohingya refugees live in the Cox's Bazar settlements. In 2017, hundreds of thousands fled violence in neighboring Myanmar following a reported military clearance operation, during which numerous alleged human rights abuses were committed. In a statement, the UN office in Bangladesh said that it had not been involved in preparations for the movement nor the identification of refugees to the new destination, Basan Chah. It added that refugees who choose to move there should have basic rights and services on the island. These should include freedom of movement to and from the Bangladesh mainland, as well as access to education, healthcare, and work. These would help lay the foundations for a productive and secure community on the island, the UN office said, before noting that comprehensive protection assessments should be carried out on Basan Chah before any relocation happens. More than 32 million of the world's poorest face being pulled back into extreme poverty because of COVID-19, leading UN economists have said. In a call for urgent investment from the international community, the UN Trade and Development Agency, UNCTAD, said that the pandemic is likely to cause the worst economic crisis in decades among least developed countries. It warned that the coronavirus risked reversing years of painstaking progress in poverty reduction, nutrition and education, with per capita economic output shrinking by 2.6% this year. An estimated 1.06 billion people live in the 47 least developed countries, which account for less than 1.3% of global economic turnover. In 2019, average earnings in these countries, which are mainly in Africa, was around $1,000, compared with a world average of $11,000, the UN agency said. Extreme poverty is defined as having an income lower than $1.90 a day. UNCTAD Secretary General Mukhisa Kituyi said that countries which had invested most in boosting production capacity were the ones that were likely to weather the global downturn caused by COVID-19. Senegal was one of only a few to have done so, Mr. Kituyi said, as it had produced cheap and rapid COVID testing kits, while Bangladesh and Ethiopia had repurposed garment factories to produce personal protective equipment. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Pandemic Journal explores the great toilet paper shortage, and also the first one back in 1973, plus more. I hope you'll stay tuned. By my count, this is New World Notes, installment number 666. A nice resonant number. It was made famous by the Book of Revelation, chapter 13, no less, at the end of the Christian Bible. And I quote, "Here is wisdom. Let him who hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Well, the whole book of Revelation reads like an acid trip gone very bad, so I don't recommend it as a trustworthy guide to living your daily life. The beast, whose number is 666, clearly is Satan. Some fundamentalist Protestant theologians have done the math and calculated that the beast is also the Pope of Rome. I should note that the Vatican begs to disagree on this fine point of interpretation. For about 13 years, I've been kicking myself for failing to do anything with evocative numbers. I could have called show number 38, the 38 special. By the year 2015, we're up to the mid-300s. I could have called an installment in January, the 357 Magnum. I thought of these joke names too late. Today's 666 may well be my last chance. Unfortunately, I can't think of any funny name apart from the number itself. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the show. Brought to you this week by Underwood's Deviled Ham, Hell of a Good Brand Cheese, and the Vatican City Tourist Bureau. Today's show is a bit of this, a bit of that, all loosely connected. Let us begin, though, with installment 3 of Pandemic Journal. Fanfare, please. Let us not waste time with trivia, like the national election, or the collapsing world economy, or the mounting global death toll from COVID-19. Rather, let us zoom in on the one key story of most importance to the lives of all Americans at the end of the year 2020. Yes, we now seem to have yet another toilet paper shortage. This is the second or third toilet paper shortage of my lifetime. The number is debatable. Do you want to count this as part of the same shortage that began in March 2020? That was number 2. Or do you want to say that number 2 was over by July and the one that began in November is yet a third one? Either way is okay with me. You decide. The fragility of our globalized, capitalist, everything-for-profit system was amply shown in this year of the pandemic. Even without panic buying, supply chains were terribly disrupted by the virus, often in unpredictable ways. We began the pandemic with a grievous shortage of masks, gloves, and other essential equipment for public health. You'll recall the unedifying spectacle of the Centers for Disease Control instructing Americans how to make their own masks out of old T-shirts. Paper masks finally became available in stores by mid-June, 3 months later. In March 2020, toilet paper sold out immediately. Paper towels and Kleenex got very hard to find. Also rubbing alcohol and household cleaning supplies. 8 or 9 months later, alcohol remains hard to find and cleaning supplies are low. Perhaps spurred by popular fears of riots and or fears of a Democratic Congress, gun sales went through the roof this summer. Even now, I am told that the supply of new guns is very low and there is a major shortage of ammunition. Whole wheat pasta was pretty much gone this spring, though white pasta remained in fair supply. Alas, I'm a whole wheat kind of guy. Spaghetti sauce sold out for a few weeks, but then rebounded. The brand of cranberry juice I prefer remains missing in action. Wasabi sauce vanished about the time my old bottle ran out and has not seemed to return. Dishwashing liquid got scarce and unscented dishwashing liquid vanished for a time. With recreational facilities closing, bicycle sales took off. But these days, American bicycle companies are offshoring their production to Asia, and the flow of new bicycles from Asia to the U.S. pretty much stopped. The owner of my friendly neighborhood bike shop said a few months back that all of his business now is repairs. He couldn't buy a new bike for love nor money. But of course, parts for repairs are also made in Asia, so we'll see what comes next. My heart leapt up this spring when I saw children riding bicycles again, families bicycling together. I hadn't seen many kids on bikes for about a generation. Months later, one sees less of that, now that the weather is getting cooler, or perhaps the bike shops ran out of spare parts. The takeaway here is that the whole system is enormously globalized, enormously fragile, and not at all resilient. By the way, medical care, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals are run on the same for-profit, low-resiliency plan as spaghetti, bicycles, toilet paper, handguns, and other consumer goods. It doesn't take much to disrupt the whole system. A dock worker strike in San Francisco, a change of government somewhere in Asia, warehouse workers getting sick in Chicago, that's all it takes to seriously disrupt the system. And a global pandemic really disrupts everything. But let us focus on toilet paper. That commodity disappeared early in the pandemic. The New Yorker magazine, in its customary tone of bemused superiority, offered a Freudian explanation for the disappearance of toilet paper. To wit, insecure Americans were panic buying toilet paper because, you see, control of one's feces is a marker of maturity and power. And the pandemic made Americans feel infantilized and powerless overall, and blah, 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 blah. A simpler explanation is that Americans know how fragile the consumer goods supply chain is. And of all the quasi-necessities of modern life, toilet paper is one you cannot make yourself. Not with Sears Roebuck bankrupt. In his newsletter, singer David Rovix offered an elegant solution based on his extensive travels in Europe. The solution is a pointy-tipped plastic squeeze bottle, the kind restaurants used to use to serve ketchup and mustard. Make a note of this. You may need this advice in the near future. How well the squeeze bottle works, I cannot say. I stocked up on toilet paper when it returned this summer. Showing admirable resourcefulness, my local small chain supermarket ran out only briefly. Then they obtained a good supply of odd brands, including commercial-grade Cottonelle, made in America for the Mexican market. It works just fine. And a roll lasts about three times as long as a standard American consumer roll. But I'm used to toilet paper shortages. I remember well the great toilet paper shortage of 1973. Most people I talk to draw a blank on that one. Let me tell you about it. There were several supply chain disruptions in the early 70s, too. The biggest one was the gasoline shortage. The Arab state members of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was trying to pressure the U.S. to revise its pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian policies. Most of OPEC placed an embargo on oil exports to the United States. The U.S. corporate press never mentioned the political motives behind the embargo. It was easier just to damn all Arabs everywhere. That trick worked again 30 years later, in 2001. How much of the oil shortage was actually the fault of the oil exporters, and how much was the fault of the U.S. oil companies, that is still not entirely clear to me. Certainly the OPEC embargo didn't help. In any case, the U.S. suffered a very inconvenient gasoline shortage. At the same time, for some reason, there was also a beef shortage, along with high meat prices. Not to mention high inflation. Yes, the early years of Richard Nixon's presidency were as much a bummer as, well, all the rest of Nixon's presidency. Then an obscure congressman from Wisconsin named Harold Froelich warned that a possible toilet paper shortage could conceivably be added to the actual gas shortage and meat shortage. That claim didn't get much traction, but joke writers for the Johnny Carson show saw it and removed the possible and the conceivably. Now, the late-night Johnny Carson TV show had around 20 million viewers. On December 19, 1973, about 30 seconds of Carson's opening monologue was jokes about America's supposed toilet paper shortage. Let's have a listen, but first this quick note. Carson's sketch ends with a joke about Mrs. Olson. This was a character in commercials for Folgers Coffee. Apparently, none of the younger housewives in town had ever been able to brew a decent cup of coffee. Mrs. Olson is always reaching into her shopping bag, pulling out a can of Folgers, and saving the day. Here's Johnny Carson.
Here's a interesting item, and it's kind of funny, but it's kind of tragic in a way. Of all the shortages we have, there's a gasoline shortage. You know what else is disappearing from the supermarket shelves? Toilet paper. Ha ha ha, you can laugh now. There is an acute shortage of toilet paper in the good old United States. We got to quit writing on it. But I want to tell you, it is serious. I just saw a commercial where... I know it's coming. Where Mrs. Olson comes in with a shopping bag, and the housewife says, forget the coffee, just give me the shopping bag. I want to tell you...
Of course, in 1973, shopping bags were made of paper. Now, Americans were never good at telling buffoonery from truth, so they panicked and immediately bought up every roll of toilet paper available for sale. And that panic buying caused a real shortage of toilet paper. As I recall, the 1973 shortage lasted only a few weeks, for there was no supply chain problem except at the far end. As for today's shortage, who knows? Honesty and transparency have never been part of any corporation's consumer product marketing strategy. Don't worry, the capitalist marketers are rushing into the breach, so to speak, with a high price alternative. High-end, high-tech bidets and combination bidet toilet units. According to the marketers, for a large fistful of dollars, you can once again make defecation the high point of your day, just like when you were two. Here is some breathless prose from my local newspaper. The headline reads, "A bidet is the perfect gift for that special person." I will read excerpts. Looking for an original gift for that extra special person this holiday season? This year, go for something that can elevate their personal care routine. Bidets can offer the perfect gift for every person on your list. They come as seats as well as standalone appliances, and they come with a variety of features so you can find the perfect match for each person on your list. To inspire you, here are some examples. The wellness enthusiast. For the one who's committed to be their best, a bidet seat is a thoughtful way to get them exactly what they're looking for. Choose a model with adjustable water temperature. Right away, they'll love how much cleaner, fresher, and confident they feel. The technology buff. Shopping for the tech enthusiast on your list can be intimidating. But the secret to choosing the right gift is understanding that the best technology serves and anticipates the needs of the human that uses it. The Washlet S550e by Toto is packed with such features, such as a sensor-activated lid, warm water spray with massage features, adjustable warm air drying, and auto-flush technology. The wand even cleans itself. The Influencer. For the one who lives for being a connoisseur, here is a gift that will crank the luxury vibes in their bathroom all the way up to 11. The NeoRest NX1 by Toto offers the epitome of intelligent, high-lux personal care. Its sophisticated silhouette is inspired by the natural beauty of pebbles shaped by water over time, and its human-centered features elevate personal care, creating the incomparable luxury bathroom experience. Now that you know the gift-giving possibilities of the bidet, shop for everyone on your list by visiting washlet.com. You'll note that, in typical American fashion, the bidet's potential contribution to enjoyable sex for your partner is entirely ignored. Perish the thought. So let us return to anal hygiene. And for those of you who don't care enough about your dearest friends to give the NeoRest NX1 by Toto, there's an inexpensive, no-plumbing alternative. The pointy-nose, squeezable, refillable ketchup and mustard bottles, endorsed by David Rovix himself. Ask for one at your nearest dollar store. You could give one of them to everyone on your shopping list without breaking the bank. As for myself, I have a couple of empty pint-sized bottles from Dr. Bronner's 18-in-1 peppermint liquid soap, which should serve almost as well as the pointy-nosed ketchup bottle, plus a good stash of toilet paper I bought when the getting was good. I don't mean to gloat. It's just that by the third time you suffer some indignity, a divorce, a colonoscopy, a toilet paper shortage, an insane president, whatever, by the third time you no longer panic. You find yourself saying, "This too shall pass." Or at my age, "This too shall pass if I manage to live through it." From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wrapping up installment number 3 of Pandemic Journal. Good night, Kimberly. Good night, Clark. And good night, Mr. Whipple, wherever you are. Time is short, so let us hop on over to our final segment of installment 666. This is a rare, optimistic talk by journalist Chris Hedges, released in early 2020. It's called The Power of Human Kindness.
I studied Arabic 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, with my Palestinian professor, Omar Atman, in Jerusalem. We met in my house on Mount Scopus, overlooking the old city, every morning. He would arrive with his books and something from his garden, olives, peaches, apricots, or a bag of pistachios. He would patiently unshell as we worked, and then push towards me. Yom fil mishmish, we would say, as we ate his apricots, literally meaning, tomorrow will be good times, and we will eat apricots. But given the long tragedy that has befallen the Palestinians, this phrase has converted into a wistful, tomorrow will never come. Omar, a polyglot who spoke German, Hebrew, and English fluently, and who had worked as a teacher in the court of King Hussein in Jordan, was determined I would not only learn Arabic, but the politesse and formalities of Palestinian society. He drilled into me what to say when someone offered me food, Islamu ideik, may God bless your hands, or when a woman entered the room, and now what al bayt, you light up the house, or when someone brought me a small cup of sugary Arabic coffee, kahwe daime, a phrase that meant, may we always drink coffee together in an occasion like this. Omar had a fondness for the Lebanese child singer Remy Bondeli, a fondness I did not share, but on his insistence, I memorized the lyrics to several of her songs. He told long, involved, shaggy dog jokes in Arabic and made me commit them to memory, although sometimes the humor was lost on me. It was armed with this cultural and linguistic fluency that I first reported from Gaza, carefully removing my shoes before entering the cramped, concrete hovels in Palestinian refugee camps, hovels that on the inside were always immaculately clean. When a plate of rice or coffee was brought to me, I responded with the politesse Omar taught me. The fact that I had taken the time to learn to be polite melted even the most suspicious of hearts. It immediately opened the door to friendships that would last years. In March of 1991, I was in Basra, Iraq, during the Shiite uprising as a reporter for the New York Times. I had entered Kuwait with the Marine Corps and then left them behind to cover the fighting in Basra. I was taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard, who in the chaos, whole army units had defected to join the rebels, had ripped their Republican Guard patches off their uniforms so as not to be identified with the regime of Saddam Hussein. I was studiously polite because of Omar with my interrogators. I swiftly struck up conversations with my guards. My facility in Arabic rendered me human. And when I ran out of things to say, I told the long, shaggy dog jokes taught to me by Omar. Perhaps it was my accented Arabic, but my guards found these jokes unfailingly amusing. I spent a week as a prisoner. I slept and ate with Iraqi soldiers, developed friendships with some, including the major who commanded the unit. And there were several moments when, trapped in heavy fighting with the rebels, they shielded and protected me. One afternoon in the driving rain, I was seated in a Pajero Jeep, hot-wired and stolen by my Iraqi captors during the frantic flight from Kuwait City. We had stopped to fill our canteens from muddy puddles. All of the water purification plants had been bombed. The muck and rainwater had already turned my own guts inside out. As I made my way to the brackish pools, I noticed a woman and two small children scooping up their hands to drink. I knew what the foul water would do to these innocents, and in the cold downpour recited W.H. Auden's epitaph on a tyrant as a kind of quiet, unintelligible blessing. Perfection of a kind was what he was after, and the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter, and when he cried, the little children died in the streets. I would hear the Iraqi soldiers whisper at night about what would happen to me once I was turned over to the secret police or Muhabarat, something they and I knew was inevitable and dreaded. That day came. I was flown on a helicopter to Baghdad and handed to the Muhabarat, whose dead eyes and cold demeanor reminded me of the East German Stasi. There was no bantering now. I was manhandled and pushed forcefully into a room and left there without food or water for 24 hours. I awoke the next day to the plaintive call to prayer, the Athan, as the first pale light crept over the city. God is greater. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of God. I went to the window and saw the heavily armed guards in the courtyard below. I did not know if I would live or die. At dawn, the women and often children climbed to the flat roofs in Baghdad to bake bread in rounded clay ovens. I was famished. I called out in Arabic to these women, "I am an American journalist. I am a captive. I have not eaten." A mother handed fresh bread to her young son, who scampered across the roofs to feed me. A few hours later, I was turned over to the International Committee for the Red Cross and driven to Jordan and freedom. Where are they now, these men and women who showed me such compassion, who ignored the role my own country had played in their oppression, to see me as one of them? How can I repay this solidarity and empathy? How can I live to be like them? I owe Omar, I owe all these people, some of whom I did not know, the miracle of human kindness and my life. I am Chris Hedges for the Amir Stein Center.
Chris Hedges, wrapping up this installment of New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that you are not alone, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.